The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always. Welcome to the Virtual Curbside. We're glad to be back with you today. We're very happy this month to be able to talk to Dr. John Heflin, pediatric orthopedic surgeon in private practice in the Salt Lake area. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Paul. Glad to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to be able to talk.
Oh, sure. We've been looking forward to be able to talk to an orthopedic surgeon for some time now. We're very glad when you were willing to subject yourself to this. And specifically, so you do pediatric orthopedic practice. You specialize in spine and back?
That's right. Yeah. I do all aspects of pediatrics, but pediatric orthopedics, I should say. But I focus primarily in trauma because, you know, we all take trauma call, but the spine has become my focus over the last 10 years, I guess.
Well, that's terrific. So we can ask you all sorts of hard questions about kids' backs.
Absolutely. And I can totally make up answers.
All right. So this week, we wanted to talk about scoliosis, which is something I think we all deal with. And I think it's important that we try to do it right. Before we start, do you have any conflicts to disclose?
I do. I'm actually a consultant for a couple of companies. I work with two spine companies, Globus Medical, as well as Orthopediatrics.
Okay. So let's just start in with scoliosis. So I think we all have some sense of what it is, but how do we define scoliosis?
First of all, there's a couple of different types of scoliosis that we generally see in the pediatric population. There's lots of different types of scoli from from the peds population into adulthood. But from a kid's perspective, we generally see four types. One would be a neuromuscular type curve, which you might see in cerebral palsy and Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. You have your syndromic type scoliosis that you might see in Marfan's syndrome and other syndromes. Congenital scoliosis, which are failures of segmentation and other vertebral anomalies, which end up creating a curve. And the one that we're going to talk about today is idiopathic, which the term idiopathic in and of itself tells you that we don't know much about it. It actually is a bit of a nebulous etiology. We know it's genetically related in some way or another. It's related to growth. You know, so as children get bigger, curves tend to get bigger. But we really don't know what causes it yet, which has been somewhat problematic figuring out how to fix it or stop it. So we're going to spend our time with idiopathic, I think, today. And there's about three different varieties of idiopathic. There's the infantile onset, which would be less than 3 years of age. We would think of as an infantile curve. About 3 to 10, we would think of that as a juvenile onset idiopathic curve. And then there's the adolescent idiopathic, which most people have had some experience with in the pediatric population out there.
Are there demographic differences that we should be thinking about? Is there any difference by sex?
There is, actually. So females seem to be more affected than males. From a race standpoint, there doesn't seem to be a big difference. But for, you know, small curves, there's not a huge difference between males and females. It's maybe a 1-to-2 ratio, where one male for every two females. When you get into the curves that are treated with braces, it's probably more in the 1-to-4 category. And then surgical curves are actually 1-to-10. So for every one male who gets surgery, you'll see about 10 females. So it does have a female predilection for whatever reasons. You know, we think it probably has something to do with the hormone milieu, I guess, that girls have relative to boys, but nobody really knows. There's been all kinds of theories out there from, you know, deficiencies in melatonin, calcitonin. There's just all kinds of different thoughts and theories, but nobody's been able to really put their finger down it. We do know that it is a bony problem. So that's really important to understand. It's not that the muscles are tight on one side and not the other. That's why you can't send somebody to a chiropractor or to physical therapy to make a curve go away, because it absolutely will not. It is a product of the bones actually twisting relative to one another. So if you think of each vertebral body is like a tuna can, the two lids are going in different directions. One's going right, one's going left. And what you're left with is a torsional deformity, which is actually the driver of the curve. The curve is a product of the twist. And so that's the part that needs to be understood. That's why you can't physical therapy away scoliotic curve.
And it's not because you were carrying your backpack on one shoulder.
Correct. Yeah, we've actually studied that, interestingly enough, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the way you sleep. It has nothing to do with, your lousy posture, looking at your iPhone all day. It has nothing to do with any of those things. In fact, it is purely a growth-related phenomenon that we have yet to figure out, despite studying it for, the last 100 years. We still haven't figured it out.
Hence the idiopathic, right?
Correct. Yes. We have a lot of idiopathic things in orthopedics, and that's probably the number one.
So what's the risk if I miss scoliosis?
The biggest risk is really just progression of deformity. And in many cases, that's not a horrible problem. It can end up being more of a cosmetic issue, I guess, as the curves get up into the 35, 40 degree range. We do know there's an association with back pain as the curves approach about 35 degrees. But when the curves get up into the bigger numbers, into the 55, 60, 70 degree range, the real risk is rapid progression over the course of your lifetime. And by that, we mean a half a degree to degree per year, every year moving forward. So, if you have a 55 degree curve as a 15-year-old, by the time you're 50 years old, you're going to have a curve that's upwards of 85, 90 degrees. And what we know is that curves in the 90 degree range start to actually affect your physiology. We start to look like we have a restrictive lung disease type or a problem in which we can actually start to see issues with increased incidence of pneumonias and other problems, gastrointestinal issues. So it actually starts to affect you when you go up into the 90 degree plus range. And actually, the mortality rate begins to increase rapidly beyond that. So it can be a deadly disease if it gets big enough.
And I think that touches on something that I think surprises me to think about, and that's that this is not just a pediatric problem, that they continue to have increasing problems into adulthood. And it's one of those many things that we try to send kids out of childhood as well equipped for adulthood as possible. But if there's that much progression in adulthood, it's that's a big responsibility.
The other issues associated with it, which is function, if you get a big curve, 65, 75 degree curve as an adult, and it's causing you intractable back pain, it makes it difficult to function. It has some cosmetic, issues associated with it, certainly. But patients can become functionally debilitated as the curves get larger. And so it's outside of being just a physiologic problem, it can actually be a functional issue that can take people out of work.
So this is right down to basics, but so how do I evaluate for scoliosis? One of the things that I would hope to do is, as I see patients, that I should be screening for scoliosis. What should I do?
Well, I think, the easiest thing to look for in any patient is symmetry. And I think, if we're actually evaluating our patients, which is, one of these things that, as in all my time in the education side of medicine, what I had tried to impress on my residents was you have to actually look at the patient. You actually have to put your hands on the patient, which means that you have to put them in a gown. You have to look at symmetry. And when we're looking at patients from a symmetrical standpoint, we're looking at their shoulders for shoulder balance. And we're looking at their chest wall for chest wall symmetry. We're looking at the waist for waist symmetry. We want to make sure that their head is centered over their pelvis in both the frontal and side planes or the sagittal coronal planes as well. Visually, you can catch scoliosis generally pretty easily. And so having a patient sort of just bend forward and like they're going to touch their toes, it's called the Adams Ford bend test. You can see the asymmetry in the rib prominence. Because it is a rotational deformity, what it does is it has a tendency to rotate the chest wall. So you'll have a rib that will be larger than the contralateral side that will be on the apex of the curve. So the first thing you want to do is you just actually want to look at the patient. And I think, as pediatricians and care providers and family practice providers, we should be taking a look at everybody's symmetry in their back and their, checking their skin and checking their overall balance. That's the easiest way to catch scoliosis, and I would say the most tried and true method.
What's the role for a scoliometer?
Well, I think scoliometers have a place. The traditional teaching is you have a scoliometer number greater than 7 degrees, and that needs an evaluation, either an X-ray or referral to a specialist. The reality is, again, just looking at a patient's back, if you can see a rib prominence, that person probably needs to be, at the very least, X-rayed. And then if you don't have access to an X-ray or feel uncomfortable taking care of those sorts of problems, referring to an orthopedist for further evaluation. In our line of work, we don't get sad when we see, kids come in with a 15 degree curve. We're kind of primary care providers for musculoskeletal problems, so we don't have to see surgical things. We can we often, and in fact, most often see non-surgical things, but that's okay because you'll be surprised to know we're actually beginning to treat some of these a little bit earlier now.
Oh,
So
interesting.
where we used to treat curves of 25 degrees or more, we're starting to treat them a lot earlier in the curve progression cycle.
So, any asymmetry, I should think about doing an X-ray. And what sort of radiography should I do?
The most common is a what we call a 36-inch plate or scoliosis film. So it's a long-standing film. We like to do our X-ray standing if we can to see what gravity is doing to affect the curve. But we like to get a picture that spans from approximately the cervical thoracic junction down to the lumbosacral junction. We like to do that with patients standing up, and if they have an obvious leg length deformity discrepancy, we like to try to accommodate for that when we can. And we generally do what we call PA views, so posterior to anterior. And the reason we do that is because when we're doing surgery, we're actually looking at the patient in a P to A plane. We look at them from the back to front, so we think back to front. So from an orthopedist perspective, we like to see things P to A. When I see things A to P, I get all confused and think that they have atypical scoliosis with a curve to the left side. As
Oh, yeah.
yeah, so it, which is another thing to think about. These kids, there's typical scoliosis and atypical scoliosis. Typical would be a right-sided thoracic curve. Atypical would be left. So, anyways, the point being, we generally take PA films, and we like to have a lateral as well. So if we can have a PA and a lateral both taking the standing position, those are really good information for the spine guy.
I was looking into this. I mean, I see references to things like MRI or sometimes skeletal maturity films. My guess is, as pediatricians, we should have some notion about skeletal maturity. We have the advantage of having a relationship with the patients that allows us to follow them over time. My guess is that beyond the scoliosis film, that we would leave the other radiography to you generally.
Generally speaking, I think that's the best choice. It's rare that we would need an MRI for a child with scoliosis, at least on initial evaluation. If there were some sort of neurological issue, of course, that might change our mind. And certainly, if there were weakness or numbness, we would get an MRI. But for just general assessment, plain films are actually the workhorse, and that's what we would recommend. I like bone age films because it gives me some idea where the child is in their development. And effectively, for those of you who have not taken a bone age film, it basically is a AP view of the left hand, and it gives us a sense of where they are in their bony development. You might ask, well, why would that matter? And the reality is, as of February of 2024, there's a classification known as the Sanders classification, which actually evaluates the growth remaining in the hand. It's a scale that goes from 0 to 8. And what we know is that the hand development is very closely related to the spine development. And so, if I have a kid who is getting close to the end of skeletal maturity with respect to their hand, Sanders 7 or Sanders 8, there really is no place for bracing or other conservative management because they're almost done growing. This being a growth-related phenomenon, we don't worry about it too much. So, a lot of decisions can be made with the bone age films. And I think the bone age, the standard PA lateral view of the spine are the two things that I would recommend you get, and that gives us a lot of information.
Who needs to see you then? Which kids should I send to see you?
Well, anybody that makes you nervous, you should send to me. But if I had to pick out children to send, anybody with an infantile curve. So anybody from the ages of 0 to 3 that has a curve, we should probably see. Most juvenile curves. So anybody from 3 to 10, who has a curve of any substance. So that would be something in the 15 to 25 plus range. I would send those patients as well. And the reason for that is because a kid with a smaller curve, 15, 18, 19 degrees, sometimes we can actually start bracing those children with what we call a nighttime bending brace. It's a brace that actually kind of curves you. It's called a Providence brace for those of you who are interested. And what we would do is we would put that on the patient to sleep in at night. And because it actually bends out their curve, it can actually guide their growth a little bit. And you can actually see some correction sometimes in these early cases.
So it helps reverse a rotational deformity.
It actually can to some degree. Now, it's not as predictable as, say,
Orthodontics.
yeah, right. Or
Yeah.
like, so with little kids from ages of 0 to 2, they have curves that are truly structural. We can often cure those curves with what's called EDF casting, extension, derotation, flexion casting. So we can cure some number of those kids from their early onset scoliosis. The juvenile onset children, we can sometimes, at least at the very least, hold their curves. And sometimes I've seen some reversal. So I would, if you suspect a curve, I would go ahead and have them seen because there's at least some chance that I could reverse that to some degree. And then, of course, anybody with who's adolescent idiopathic range, probably same thing, greater than, 20 degrees, likely needs to be seen. Now, if you have a child who's 17 or 18 years old, nearly skeletally mature with a curve of 35 degrees or so, we don't really need to see that patient necessarily because they, in theory, shouldn't get any worse. But they still probably should be followed with an X-ray just to make sure we get some serial films to make sure that they aren't continuing to progress. Even though we don't expect them to do that, it's entirely possible, I guess, could if they have a collagen disorder or some other driver of their scoliosis.
At the very least, you could help map out what they should expect to do going forward.
Correct. Yeah. And that gives them at least some information.
Okay, so I've sent somebody to see you. You've already mentioned some of the things that would help you decide what you're going to do, the age, the kind of scoliosis. And I think you've touched on this already. There are some kids who you're just going to observe. And conservative therapies, things like physical therapy, chiropractic, tend not to be helpful.
Well, I think it depends on what the problem is. No, those modalities are not going to cure scoliosis. In all likelihood, they're probably not even going to slow it down a whole lot. Now, a lot of these kids do have back pain associated with their spinal deformity, or maybe they have back pain in conjunction with their spinal deformity unrelated. But physical therapy and chiropractic do play a role in managing back pain and managing posture. I think postural awareness and, placing your body in the right place in space and not hunching forward or backward or whatever is important. And so I think there is a role, certainly, for physical therapy and for chiropractic work. But in all likelihood, it's not going to change the natural history of the curve.
Okay. So going beyond that, you mentioned, could you enlighten us a little bit more about bracing, how you make choices about bracing, and what kind of braces you use?
There's a couple of different types of braces we tend to use nowadays, or at least braces that I use. For smaller curves, really less than 30 degrees or so, I often will use something called a nighttime bending brace, which we just talked about a little bit. I try to use those with curves that are between roughly 15 and 30 degrees in children who are still growing a lot. So kids in the, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year range on up to 13 or 14, we can use the Providence brace for the smaller curves. Providence brace is good even in the adolescent idiopathic population for pushing off the day brace. So if you have a kid with a 20-degree curve, sometimes you can put them in the Providence and you can keep them out of the day brace for a little bit longer because the day braces are less well tolerated. And if you were to say, why do braces fail? It's usually because nobody wears them.
Are the tolerance issues sensitivity about having to wear something, or is it discomfort, or both?
I think it's a combination of all that. I think a lot of people really feel conscientious about the brace. Naturally, if you're going to wear a brace, people are going to see that you're different than other children. And of course, at that age, kids aren't always nice. And so I think from a social perspective, it can be hard, which is why I like to try to push off the daytime brace as much as I can. A brace is called a TLSO brace, or Boston is the more common. There's also the Rigaud Chanel, which is the newer version of the traditional Boston brace. And that one's worn during the day. That one provides both a little bit of flexion of the spine, but more importantly, a rotational, sort of a torsional correction, I guess. And that's our mainstay for bigger curves, 25 to 45. That brace has been pretty well studied and been shown to be about 70% effective in that population who have a lot of growth remaining. That would be in the study that I'm referring to was a study back in 2012, I think. It looked at efficacy of the TLSO brace, a Boston brace, in patients from RZR 0 to 2 with curves 25 to 45 degrees is the population that it was very effective in, about 70, 75%, somewhere in that range.
How long would you continue bracing? You said that with a more significant curve, that there could be progression for a long time. How long could someone conceivably end up in a brace?
So for the Because it's a growth-related phenomenon, right? We have to brace these patients until they are just about to stop growing. But it's not the whole patient, it's their spine, right? We shut down in phases. Our head stops growing first, our spine, hands, and feet stop next, then our arms and legs, and then our chest wall, and finally our clavicles are, clavicles are funny, they're first to the party, last to leave. So when we're looking at when can we stop bracing, it's using that Sanders classification I talked about before. A Sanders 7 is thought to be safe. And for girls, that's usually about 14, 14 and a half. For boys, 15, 15 and a half in general. That doesn't mean they won't stop growing. It just means their spine's not going to grow. And that being true, then we should be safe.
Gotcha. Which kids need surgical management?
So the bigger curves, curves that are big and curves that are fast, I guess. So when we look at curves that make us nervous, it's going to be really anything over about 50 degrees. And that number might be going down a little bit. There's some data, again, as of 2024, that would suggest that maybe curves in the 45 degree range may be progressive over the course of people's lifetime enough so that it might warrant surgical intervention. So any kid as of this date, 50, 55 degrees, I say, is a surgical candidate. We also think of kids needing surgery who have curve progressions of greater than 10 degrees over about a 6 month period. We think that those are very aggressive curves and they may need stabilization as well. So those are the kids that we typically will undertake into surgery for posterior spinal instrument infusion. And that's where we use our screws and rods and we sort of straighten things up as much as we can and stabilize the curve for their lifetime.
Any idea about what proportion of kids end up in the faster progressing or the more severe cases?
Well, it's usually a product of the rotational deformity more than anything else. So if you have a kid do an adductor bend test and they've got a really big rib prominence, that suggests a pretty aggressive rotational deformity. So the more rotational deformity you have there, the more likely you're going to have progression of curve. Aside from that, it's really hard to pick out, who's who, who's going to progress, which is why we have to follow pretty closely. I watch most of these kids about every 6 months, and I think that's a good time frame to be following children who are going through the rapid phase of growth. So I would say for children 11 to 13, 14 years of age, if they have a curve, they probably should be followed about every 6 months so that you can respond to that appropriately if the curve were to get larger, large enough to need management.
And short answer from our end is that regular careful evaluation is not a bad thing. It's a good
Not a
thing.
bad thing at all. Very good thing. Yeah.
As with so many other things. And to some extent, both trusting what you see and trusting a sort of a gut sense that there's something that is out of proportion or out of symmetry.
Absolutely. I think the symmetry question is always a big deal. And that goes for the neurologic exam too. When you're checking it out, you really need to check, make sure their strength is good and make sure their reflexes are equal and all those sorts of things because asymmetry is always worrisome, especially on a neuro exam. So if we've got patches of skin that are numb compared to others, or discernible weakness between one side and the other, or clonus on one side, or no reflexes on one side, these are all very odd things that need to be evaluated further. So symmetry is always your friend.
Yeah, very helpful. Anything else you want to share about scoliosis?
It's a nebulous problem that we just don't understand. I think being more proactive than less, and watching kids carefully and sending them when they start to show deformity is the best thing you can do for a kid. Don't be shy about sending us kids with small curves. We're happy to see them, happy to follow them, and that often prevents them from ending up on the OR table. And oddly enough, as much as I like surgery, I also like doing everything I can to avoid surgery. So if we can keep kids off the operating room table, I think we've done them a big service.
Well, and having the sense that prevention, that's sort of the key to what we do, can prevent a lot of problems, as you've mentioned, functional problems, cosmetic problems, all sorts of things. And so it's a great thing to do. Well, John, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate being able to talk to you today. We'll look forward to talking to you about back pain next week. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@thecurb.com, and we'll deal with those in a couple of weeks. Thanks, John.
Hey, thank you. It was great.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns.
None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.